Good morning. It's Thursday, the 9th of May, and this is Govind Raj Ethiraj broadcasting and streaming from and headquartered in Mumbai, India's financial capital. Our top stories and themes for today. The stock markets are flat once again as they brace for weeks of uncertainty. Oil prices slide below $82 a barrel. Could they drop further? Why only vegetarian thali prices are rising? Are grounded airlines doomed to stay that way? And non-bank finance companies are racing to find new sources of capital as banks tighten their wallets.
This is a Core Report with Govind Raj Ethiraj.
Markets stay flat once again. It's almost a month to go for the results of India's 2024 general elections on June 4th, and markets are as flat as they come and go. Pre-election results jitters have now set into the markets, which, as we've discussed, is reasonably logical and to be expected despite a victory priced into the market already. Now, this will be an interesting month in the markets until June 4th, Tuesday, the day the results of the elections will be announced. So the markets are, of course, open on that day. On Wednesday, the BSE Sensex, after moving up and down 611 points, ended at 73,466 and down 45 points. The Nifty 50, on the other hand, was almost unchanged and settled at 22,303. Meanwhile, Saturday, May 18th will not be a holiday for those in the stock markets, and we'll see a special trading session to test a disaster recovery site for the National Stock Exchange. Now, these tests do happen periodically and are important to ensure continuity were something to go wrong with the primary trading systems. Oil prices fall again. Oil prices fell in Asian trade on Wednesday, thanks mostly to rising crude and fuel inventories in the United States, a sign of weak demand and a key trigger to keeping prices down. Brent crude was quoting around $82 a barrel and even slipping below that momentarily. Now, these are the lowest levels since mid-March. U.S. crude stocks rose by about 500,000 barrels in the week ended May 3rd, according to market sources, citing American Petroleum Institute figures to Bloomberg. Prices of vegetable thalis are up, and prices of onions, tomatoes, and potatoes have risen again, taking the price of a home-cooked vegetarian thali by 8% in April to about 27 rupees versus about 25 rupees in the same month last year, according to a report from Crisil Ratings, which computes the price of a thali every month. Broilers or chicken prices continue to fall, pushing the cost of a non-vegetarian thali by 4% to about 56 rupees versus about 59 rupees last year. The price of broiler chicken fell 12% year-on-year, making the non-vegetarian thali that we spoke of much cheaper, and broilers account for about 50% of the total cost of that non-vegetarian thali. Poultry industry representatives the Core has been speaking to in recent weeks have hinted at soft prices, though did caution that heat waves could have an impact. The fact, of course, is that over a longer period, broiler prices have largely stayed stable as opposed to vegetable prices, which have been gyrating quite wildly. A vegetarian thali, just to sum it up, has roti, onions, tomatoes, potatoes, rice, dal, curd, and salad. A non-vegetarian thali has all of them, but chicken instead of dal, at least for the purpose of computation. Now, Crisil works out these average costs of a home-cooked thali based on input prices from the north, south, east, and west of India. Now, more specifically, there were fewer onions available in the market and the potato crop in West Bengal was damaged, which in turn led to prices rising, said Crisil. By the way, rice and pulses prices have increased too by about 14% and 20% year on year. And this is something that we've been tracking when we look at inflation numbers and particularly within that food inflation. Sequentially, that's month on month, the price of a vegetarian thali in April was flat thanks to a 4% decline in onion prices and a 3% fall in fuel costs. The prices of tomatoes and potatoes continue to rise. Non-bank finance companies are rushing to diversify their borrowings as banks hold back. Offices in Mumbai's financial districts in Bandra Kurla Complex and Lower Parel, among others in South Mumbai, have been buzzing with activity in recent weeks. One reason lights are on, perhaps longer than normal, is all the firefighting that's going on, including with raising funds, and I'll come to that in a moment. earlier this week, it was reported that IIFL Finance, who was asked by the Reserve Bank of India to halt its gold loan business, was now facing a cash crunch as banks were not lending to it right now because of a regulatory shadow. While IIFL Finance is in the crosshairs, it's quite clear that non-bank finance companies in general are on the back foot when it comes to raising funds, which is, of course, the key raw material for their business. The problem, of course, started last year when the Reserve Bank of India raised their risk weights and thus the cost of capital. NBFCs are now furiously diversifying their capital sources since close to 70% of their funds comes from banks themselves and non-convertible deposits or investments from investors. It is, of course, a continuing reminder that the opportunity for credit is so large in India that non-bank finance companies can create products that are attractive to customers despite borrowing from the people, which is the banks, who could also be competing with them. So I could go to a bank or a non-bank finance company to take the same loan for the same product or object, but quite likely I could go to the non-bank finance company because the processing might be faster and easier. Rating agency CRISIL is saying that quarterly commercial paper issuances by NBFCs have hit a 4.5-year high of about 1.2 lakh crore rupees in the Jan to March 2024 quarter, a level that was last seen in July to September 2019. This is still lower, CRISIL points out, than the highs of about 3 lakh crore rupees seen in July to September 2018. According to CRISIL, while banks remain the dominant funding source, about 43% right now, non-bank finance companies will look to diversify their resource profile given the increase in risk weights for bank funding. CRISIL says that there is no cause for worry in this diversification that is happening or the rise of commercial paper because, among other things, issuances are largely backed by shorter tenure assets such as loan against shares, gold loans, and unsecured loans. Also, NBFCs are issuing longer tenure commercial paper now as against the shorter tenures in the past, and overall asset liability management should not be a challenge. Now, all of this could either sound encouraging or a little worrying. So I spoke to Ajit Veloni, Senior Director at CRISIL Ratings, who studies this, and I began by asking him how non-bank finance companies were coping in this changed environment.
So largely, when you look at funding for NBFCs, you know, I think unlike a bank where you do have access to deposits and the retail base, NBFCs are largely wholesale funded. And the two biggest funding avenues are loans from the banking system, or you borrow through debentures, typically subscribers being mutual funds, bank treasuries, or insurance. So if you look at, say, for the last 4 or 5 years, typically bank loans and NCDs would be about 70 to 75% of the total borrowings for NBFCs. And of course, November was a big event when the regulator did increase the risk weight. So the risk weights for lending to higher rated NBFCs went up by about 25 percentage points, effective November 23. And we have seen, therefore, that the bank lending to NBFCs, which had gone up from 5 lakh crore, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, it had hit a peak of nearly 13 lakh crore in that period. But since December to March, we've actually seen it steady now. So it's actually the same value, which is indicative that banks are being a little more cautious when it comes to lending NBFCs. And effectively, NBFCs are having to look at other alternative sources of funding to fund their growth.
So the number is showing that bank loans to NBFCs have not risen since December.
Absolutely, yeah. So the data put out by the regulator, they do have lending to NBFCs, HFCs, and also there's government financial institutions, which is your PFC and REC. So if you exclude the government financial institutions, what you have is lending to NBFC and HFC. It had about 13.03 lakh crore, if I recall, in November. And since then, it's been a similar figure. March, we ended at about 13.2. So clearly, it's flattened out ever since the circular came out.
One of the things that you've pointed out as CRISIL is that the commercial paper volumes have now gone up. So if you can define commercial papers for us and how that is playing a role in helping NBFCs raise more funds.
So I did mention at the beginning that the two largest funding avenues being bank loans as well as NCDs. In addition to the same, I think there are other sources. One is securitization, second is ECBs, and the third is commercial paper. So incidentally, commercial paper was really in the limelight during this 2018 period when we did have this whole confidence deficit. And what we saw is volumes of commercial paper, because this is shorter tenure money market instrument with a maximum of a 1 year tenure. And what we saw in that period is, if I recall back in 2018, we had as much as the issuance volume was as high as 3 lakh crore in a quarter. That value had come down to as low as 50,000 crore because from the investor community point of view, there was a kind of a confidence deficit. If NBFCs took a lot of shorter tenure borrowing, and they felt there's a potential asset liability mismatch which came in. Plus, during that old period, a lot of the CPs raised, being a shorter tenure instrument, were about a 2-month maturity. What we have seen, and ever since, I would say, the November circular, we looked at the data for Jan to March quarter, and we saw that the issuance volume actually has come back and it's hit a 4-year high of about 1.2 lakh crore. And the good part is that there was not too much of a concern, with not worrisome, that you have a shorter tenure borrowing going up, because as opposed to earlier where most of the CPs were a 2-month tenure, what we found was a good healthy issuance of about, 25% of the issuance actually was 9 to 12 month tenure, which means you were going to the maximum tenure possible. And even as compared to the 2 months, we saw a lot of issuances which were even in the 3-month and 4-month tenure. So that seemed to indicate that there's not as much of a worrisome at this juncture. Second, I think, is the regulator itself has also mandated what's called as a liquidity coverage ratio, an LCR. And most of the NBFCs and HFCs are maintaining much higher than regulatory requirement in terms of LCR out there. And fundamentally, of course, the sector is also doing well. Asset quality at this juncture is fairly stable. Balance sheets are very strong.
I'm assuming CFOs of all NBFCs are working hard now and constantly, scouring the market to see. But, from the sourcing side, what's the interest rate? What's the diversity like between, let's say, banks, which are obviously the lion's share right now, and all these other sources that you pointed out?
I think we are at a very interesting time. If you look at it, typically the capital markets react much faster to what you see as the benchmark, broad market rates. The bank loans are transmission is a little slower. I think today we are at a stage where we think that the full effect of, the interest rate cycle change would possibly be done by, say, June to September quarter. And there's already a talk of a potential rate cut. And, while it's being deferred, what we have seen is that the capital market rates today are fairly close to the bank loan rate. So if you take a broader range and you look at the top rated players at, say, a AAA level, you're finding that you're able to borrow anywhere from a range of 7.9% going all the way to about 8.8%. In fact, interestingly, even ECBs, where earlier the hedging costs used to be high, today, if you look at the SOFR, what is called the secured overnight funding rate, that's about 5.3. And if you add in the risk premia as well as hedging cost, we are seeing NBFCs are able to raise even ECBs ranging from, say, 8.25 to about 8.8 rate. So today, all the sources of funding are available within, say, a plus minus 1%. And when NBFCs from an asset side, I think there is a strong growth. Last year, the sector grew at about 18%. The estimate is this year too. Growth should be anywhere from 15 to 17%. So for CFOs, I think it's more about ensuring that funding is available. And it may not be the cheapest cost of funding, but it's about ensuring funding access at an optimal cost. And therefore, the ability to access each of these funding costs within a particular range.
But you're saying if you were to blend it, either ways, it's for, the whole basket is between 8 and 9% currently for AAA NBFCs.
Absolutely. So it's a range. It does differ from entity to entity and the rating wise. Yeah. But it's at a broad range available between 8 to 9%. We could see, therefore, some impact in profitability. But if you see, we've had a very high profitability in fiscal 24. So our estimate is about, let's say, 10 to 20 bips impact could be that profitability. But even then, it'll remain fairly healthy and probably higher than what we saw about 2 years ago.
I mean, this is a very broad question and you need not put a figure on it, but would, let's say, the 80% of the market be AAA or is it the other way around?
Yeah, I think what we have largely seen since 2019 is that if you look at the investors in the market, especially the mutual funds, I think they're guided by their own policies for each of the funds. So the preference is typically to go with the higher rated. So the access to capital market instruments, typically we have seen is more at a AA and above in that sense. And they also, from a size of the industry too, if you look at the top 10 NBFCs, about 56-57% of the NBFC sector AUM is contributed by 10 NBFCs, the top 10. So to that extent, you will find that the issuances is skewed towards those who are rated at AA.
Right, that's very useful. Ajit, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me here.
Meanwhile, the Reserve Bank of India has warned some non-bank lenders against disbursing cash loans in excess of the permissible limit of 20,000 rupees, according to sources and a letter seen by Reuters, and a move that's likely to stop large cash payouts to those borrowing against gold. This advisory obviously comes within weeks of regulatory action against IIFL Finance, which is also India's second largest gold loan player for various violations. Now, the interesting thing is that loans beyond 20,000 rupees in cash were never allowed by the Income Tax Act, but some finance companies were apparently securing indemnities from the borrowers and then giving them large amounts of cash. Once grounded, always grounded. First, the news. After the Tata and Singapore Airlines owned Vistara Airlines saw a spate of cancellations because pilots did not turn up in the first week of April, exactly a month later, it's the turn of sister company and fully Tata-owned company Air India Express. Air India Express reportedly cancelled more than 70 international and domestic flights from Tuesday night till Wednesday morning thanks to senior crew members going on mass sick leave. The airline said in a formal statement that a section of its cabin crew reported sick at the last minute starting Tuesday night, resulting in flight delays and cancellations. They were engaging with the crew to understand the reasons and also actively trying to address the issue with its guests or passengers. An Air India Express employee union has listed a series of demands and complaints ranging from terminations of long-serving employees, contrary to job security promised post-acquisition, and removal of allowances. It is indeed interesting to see that union action, as I have pointed out before, is back in India on the front pages, but thanks to Air India, which for the best part of three decades made more news for its union actions rather than its service. The Tatas have a tough battle ahead. Speaking of battles, exactly a year ago, the Wadia Group-backed Go First ceased operations and filed for voluntary insolvency. Now, there have been several attempts to revive the airline, like there have been for Jet Airways, which has been in and out of insolvency courts since 2019, or 5 years ago when it shut down. Yet, in both cases, it inevitably seems to be one step closer and two steps back. This is despite various suitors coming forth, making bids, trying to arrange funds, and obviously get things going. I also must admit that the one reason this story interests me continually is because I see Jet Airways aircraft, including those wide-bodied Boeing 777s and Go Air Airbus A320s, parked in various airports, or rather at various airports, including in Mumbai. And I never fail to wonder, if everyone can see that these aircraft worth tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars at one time are rotting away, why can't we move faster through these bankruptcy and insolvency processes? Now, the details of these cases can be intricate and complicated, but what is not complicated and easy to see that time is flying quite literally and aircraft are not immortal. I reached out to Nitin Sarin, aviation legal expert and managing partner of Sarin & Company, who incidentally appeared in court for one of the lessors of Go First, and I began by asking him whether there was something in the very nature of the aviation industry or the bankruptcy resolution process in India which ensured almost that once an airline was grounded, it was next to impossible to take off again.
I think the fact that we're talking about airlines being grounded in the beginning means that they've been through a lot. It takes a lot for an airline to give up. And when an airline gets grounded, that basically means that they've tried whatever is possible and they cannot make it. So that's the first point, that they're already in a very destitute sort of situation before they decide to ground. Secondly, why it's difficult for them to get off the ground is two reasons. Number one, their costs are all, for example, in foreign currency. So any day that they are grounded, they are losing millions and millions of, you know, very valuable foreign exchange in the form of US dollars. So that's very difficult to recover from. Number two, if an airline has gone through or does go through the insolvency process, for example, it's unfortunately just too slow. It needs to be a quick turnaround within a couple of weeks rather than a couple of months or years, because as we know, aircraft and aviation personnel are perishable in nature. They cannot be grounded and they cannot lie around. They need to be constantly working, generating funds. So that's the basic reason, in my opinion, why once an airline gets grounded, it just snowballs out of control and they can't get back up.
So let me pick up a specific point. In Go Air, the Delhi High Court said that they could, if I got that right, that they were deregistering the aircraft. Now, is that a different way of solving the problem compared to what's been done before?
The problem in this particular Go Air case stems from the fact that, you know, a standard financing or leasing contract will have a clause in it saying that if for any reason you go into insolvency, we have a right to terminate our agreement. Now, that's one example. But in this Go Air's example, not only did that get triggered by Go Air going themselves to the insolvency court, but they were also in heavy default of their obligations, you know, payment and rent, etc. They were far behind. Now, that being said, it was the lessors who terminated their contracts with Go Air the moment they filed for voluntary insolvency. And the next
The result of that is you go to the DGCA and you apply for deregistration, because that's your first step on stopping an aircraft from being flown and your very first step in taking possession with yourself. In that interim period, while our applications had been filed, GoAir's application for insolvency was heard, reserved, and finally admitted. Now, we were arguing all along that, look, we terminated prior to the 10th of May when that application was admitted, which is really, you know, starts the process under the IBC. So we were forced to go to the Delhi High Court saying that, look, the DGCA is not processing our applications. Please direct them on X, Y, and Z grounds to do so.
In general, once again, now, what is it that seems to hold back the recovery process of either a GoAir or a Jet Airways? Now, let me point to two or three perhaps external or internal factors. One could be, let's say, engine parts. Second could be, obviously, finance. Third could be, let's say, payments to people who are supplying everything from fuel to, let's say, services at the airport and so on. So where, again, is the sort of biggest hurdle in this whole chain? Or rather, what are the hurdles that are the most difficult to surmount?
In my opinion, it would be a combination of all of these. GoAir seems to have, as far as the engine parts issue or the Pratt & Whitney issue goes, they have seemed to use that as a pawn. That's their central reasoning that they've used for their failure. But we must also bear in mind the whole world has also used Pratt & Whitney engines. So it's not just them. So it's a good excuse that they have found, although a very, very serious one. The other reason, which I genuinely feel, is that, as I said earlier, our resolution process is too slow. We need to, you know, we can't have this luxury of application after application after application in our insolvency process, which has really riddled, you know, and has plagued Jet Airways, for example. They should have been off the ground. You know, they had an aircraft painted in their livery. At that stage, they should have been ready to go. But they haven't been. And that's a much deeper problem of a judiciary that is slow. It tries to encompass everything, tries to make everyone happy, everyone heard, which unfortunately, with the workload that they have, results in very slow resolutions.
So Jet Airways is a good example. I mean, the airline closed about 5 years ago to this date almost. And the aircraft, if you were to pass through Mumbai, you can see them still parked there, including the 777s. Why is it that, again, very conceptually, no one recognizes this as a problem, including people in the courts, that, you know, this, all these assets worth tens of millions of dollars will obviously rust and go to seed if they're not used and put to good use?
You see, I think there's, number one, there needs to be a lot more awareness about this. You know, we are still a very small industry compared to the other industries in this country. I think we need a lot of support from the ministry also to bring this up, you know, with corporate affairs, etc., to amend our regulations to cater for this. You know, it's you bring up very serious concerns. There's no reason why those Jet Airways 777s, which, mind you, are assets of the corporate debtor of Jet Airways, you know, those used to have value and they've been reduced to nothing by just lying there. So it is, you bring up very valuable points, and you know, people like myself have been harping on social media that we need amendments to our regulations. We need special regulations to deal with aviation bankruptcies, etc.
So as we go forward, Nitin, you know, when you look at how similar situations are handled overseas, because I'm sure bankruptcies happen all over the world, what would you say are the one or two things that we need to focus on and maybe amend laws? I mean, again, and which would be the best examples to learn from?
You see, there was during COVID, these are things which are not very talked about out of the aviation industry, but there were several airlines around the world that went through, you know, restructuring within days. We're not even talking weeks. We need specialists like that, you know, to be the ones handling all of these things in India, whether that means a specialized insolvency court, which, you know, has resolution professionals or, you know, judges and tribunals who are professionals from the industry. We need those. You know, that it's counsel. Being a lawyer, I have spent days trying to explain to a bench what the very basics of aviation are. I don't expect the judges to know aviation at all. And that's why we need specialized, you know, benches and tribunals to deal with things like this.
We are in one of the world's hottest aviation markets. And if this has to grow in a way that also attracts more capital and people feel comfortable in terms of taking plunges in new ventures and so on. What do you feel we need to do to communicate a sense of, you know, even as, let's say, the parts that you talked about, including, let's say, having speedier court resolutions and so on, what else can we do to make this sector seem safer from a business point of view?
Number one, it hits such a sensitive, in a positive way, nerve. We have such a beautiful industry right now. You know, you get to travel to the rest of the world. You don't see this growth anywhere. So we are extremely lucky to be experiencing what we are. But at the same time, we need predictability. That is key. We don't want a government to come into power today and a government to change tomorrow and their policies to be completely different. We want, from that perspective, a seemingly westernized culture where it is respected that if something was started today, it will be seen through till its fruition, till its end. And that's ultimately what gives the stability and what gives business people the security to come and invest. And that's what we lack. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. And that's why, unfortunately, fortunately for myself, the only people in the chain who make a lot of money are lawyers and consultants, etc., because of the complexities of doing business in this country.
Right, Nitin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was The Core Report with me, Govindraj Ethiraj. Do stay connected with more of our coverage at The Core. You can check out our website or sign up to our newsletter for our exclusive stories, one in-depth feature a day on www.thecore.in. Do also track us on LinkedIn, where we usually post synopses or extracts of our top stories and interviews. We would love your feedback on how we can make business more interesting and relevant, including, of course, India's vibrant manufacturing sector. So write to us at feedback@thecore.in. And thank you once again for listening.